She blows up stereotypes, literally. Having helped test more than 900 scientific myths, this week's guest had to blow up salary inequality in the workplace, too. Techonomics host Jason Middleton discusses how to apply the scientific method to our everyday lives with television presenter and host, and now author, Carrie Byron. That conversation starts now.
Hello, and thanks for listening, and welcome back. This week, we're going to blow up a couple of stereotypes with the aid of a demolition expert who casually drops the phrase blast zone into several of her conversations. A reality-based science show veteran and host, Carrie Byron has walked the science walk on several shows, including Mythbusters, White Rabbit, Head Rush, Punkin' Chunkin', Thrill Factor, and a few more. Ms. Byron has a calling, urging women and girls to get engaged and involved in science, technology, engineering, and math.
As a young girl, at least when I was growing up, we weren't taught that you could fail. Failure was not an option. It was something that you avoided. And I feel like that may be that's a stumbling block for a lot of girls my age trying to get into a lot of STEM-related fields, because you really do have to fail and learn continually to be an engineer or to be a scientist.
Ms. Byron has also faced down and won a battle over wage inequality when she discovered she was paid less than equally qualified male co-hosts. And here we go.
Carrie Byron, and I wrote Crash Test Girl.
So many places we could start here, but what first caught my eye was the macro theme of the book is using scientific method to do things that aren't necessarily scientific, but it helps you get to a certain place. Can you tease that out for us?
Well, I believe the scientific method to be a critical thinking tool, and I believe that critical thinking you can apply to any situation and any problem to help you get through it. So I used it as a life methodology and an overlying theme. But really the ethos of the book was it's a memoir, and it's my journey to try to learn to be brave and create opportunities for myself.
And that's why we could have gone a lot of different directions to start the conversation, because you have lived a rather full life. And how did you wind up on this book? I mean, can you tell us a little bit of the journey, or maybe have you had this in the back of your mind the whole time?
You know, I never actually wanted to write a book. This was not on my bucket list at all. But, you know, when I've traveled around talking to a lot of people who grew up watching the show, and I've met a lot of women who are just kind of starting out on their journeys. And I feel like I originally started to write this book for the 20-year-old girl I was. I made Head Rush, which is the TV show on Science Channel, for the 12-year-old girl I used to be. I feel like I wrote this book for the 20-year-old woman just on the brink of a journey, in sort of a, if I could give myself advice for life, what would it be? And this is the book.
Very cool. Well, your resume obviously is robust. It's Head Rush, Punkin' Chunkin', Thrill Factor, Strange Tips, America Declassified. Oh, yeah, Mythbusters. White Rabbit, which is where I discovered you, actually, because my daughter watches White Rabbit like it's a job.
Wait a minute. You didn't discover me till White Rabbit, even though Mythbusters was a totally San Francisco Bay Area show?
Don't be mad, but I lived in L.A. at the time.
Oh.
I just wasn't into it.
Forgiveness.
I get it. I get it now, though. I do. I'm going to pull back out again, because in the valley you hear, I have the confidence to fail. Have you always felt like you had a confidence to fail, or were you outrunning failure?
Absolutely not. I feel like as a young girl, at least when I was growing up, we weren't taught that you could fail. Failure was not an option. It was something that you avoided. And I feel like that's a stumbling block for a lot of girls my age trying to get into a lot of STEM-related fields, because you really do have to fail and learn continually to be an engineer or to be a scientist. And so I think a lot of people go into careers where it's easier for them. So, you know, it's only after Mythbusters in this long career that I became such a STEM advocate. But the idea of failing and learning from it, crashing and learning, as I like to say, has really become sort of a battle cry for me, and something that I constantly try to instill in my daughter and people that I meet.
And how old is your daughter? You said eight, technically?
I got an 8-year-old.
Mine's 9. A little bit into STEAM, too. What do you think about that? Should that replace STEM?
I always throw in the A. I get a lot of pushback from scientists, but I'm like, listen, it's curiosity and creativity that make a good scientist.
Right.
Because you really have to think outside the box to find the answers to problems. So I think artists and scientists really roll hand in hand.
This is another theme on the show, is artificial intelligence. And I've kind of landed on the whole thing where I think we should let AI do the stuff that we don't need to be creative about, and let us have more time to be creative.
I love that angle so much. That's really good. That's a great angle.
Because I think, you know, I mean, to handle the mundane, and then coding becomes almost like plumbing in a way. It's a trade at that point. You just keep things running, and then we get to do what we do best, which is break things and move fast. So
I like breaking things and moving fast.
I know you do. I've seen plenty of examples. Could we talk a little bit, too, about your experience in the industry and the poor experience you had with pay inequality? That's also a theme on this show that we cover. It's a silver thread that runs through a lot of it. We don't really cotton to the idea of pay inequality being okay, especially in Silicon Valley.
It's funny, I put this in the book as my personal story, but I didn't realize it was going to be such a hot button, but everybody has jumped on it. You know, it was a very small period of my life, but I realized after I'd been on the show for years that my two co-hosts, my male co-hosts, were being paid a significant amount more than I was on a regular basis. And I didn't know because, you know, we don't sit there and be like, how much you getting your paycheck? Like,
right.
I just assumed we all got paid the same. We had the same title. I'd been on the show longer than any of the guys, other than Jamie and Adam, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured seniority, I mean, there's no reason I would be paid
sure.
less. And then it just came up one day because we were about to negotiate a new contract. And they're the guys were talking to me. They're like, maybe we should ask for this. And I'm like, wait, how much are you making? And then when I found out, I was in shock. I couldn't believe that I was just automatically being paid less.
Yeah.
That I'd been offered less from the get.
For no damn good reason.
For absolutely no reason. So, you know, I called and was negotiating. Like, listen, I'm not asking for more. I'm asking for fair. I want to be paid the same. And if you can give me a logical reason why I'm getting paid less for the same job title, we have the same job, we all do the same thing. You know, they tried to go to educational background. I'm like, I have the same degree as Tori from the same school.
Right.
So nope. And Grant has a 4-year degree. It's a Bachelor of Science, but it's not. It's the same level of education. There's nothing that you can give me right now that's going to make me back down. So finally, they paid me the same. And then I don't know if it was some sort of just automatic thing that happened or if it was just a little like jab, but they gave the guys a raise. So that just made my blood boil. I went straight to LA and I interviewed every single agent I could find that would take my meeting. I was on reality-based science television. So I called every agent and I found the most feminist agent I could find. He had a strong mama figure and he's like, no, I will fight for you. And so Tori and Grant joined my cause. Now every contract, we have a League of All Nations.
Very cool.
They are both very feminist men as well, which I applaud.
I'm happy to hear that there was a good solution to that. In your answer, you said you were shocked to find out. How long did it take to go from shock to anger to action?
Oh, that was minutes.
I bet.
I wanted to give them the benefit of the doubt, and I wanted to talk to him in person, and I was actually negotiating with a woman, so it just felt a little more icky. I'm just like, lady, come on, aren't we in this together? And
isn't there a Madeleine Albright quote about that, I think?
Oh,
Women who don't help women? Yeah, I think I remember that one.
Yes.
Let's talk about Mythbusters and your pivot out of Mythbusters. What happens when your career goes to the next step after that show?
You know, I was shook after Mythbusters ended because I had defined myself for over a decade in this role as that person. So for me, it was a little bit of a complete regrouping and restructuring of my headspace to actually go on to the next thing. But I realized I really like TV and I'm going to have to create my own opportunities. So I just, you know, I got my woman pants on and I just started cold calling people and letting people know I was there and pitching shows myself and trying to create a new space for myself within television, which, you know, I was lucky enough to find. I keep finding new shows to do that are based on science or travel and adventure, which is one of my other passions. I'm just going to keep going because I really think that science literacy often is going to come from places that you don't expect, like entertainment.
Let's talk about your relationship with Netflix. How does that process look? I'd love to get under the hood on who approaches who and how that goes. And I know you probably can't get too specific, but if you could paint a picture for us.
I can't get too specific because the specifics are kind of, they're not at my level sometimes. Netflix approached, I think what really happened is Hulu had Mythbusters and people searched Mythbusters so much on Netflix that they're like, how can we make a Mythbusters show? Hey, those guys, they're free right now. So they went to the production company who did Mythbusters and they're like, can you make a show with the build team? And then, you know, they came to us. And I think that our production company was a little in shock how much creative control was given to them. They were so used to network notes and a lot of cooks in the kitchen that I think they were almost panicking when they're like, wait, you're not going to tell me what I can and cannot do. It was a beautiful process in that regard.
The other way to look at it is enough rope to hang yourself with too.
Yes.
Yeah, right?
Yes.
One of my favorite parts of White Rabbit was you're on a date and you're controlling the person sitting across the table from you.
It was more of a we're really good friends.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like a setup scenario. It was more like Tori and I have lunch all the time. So for me to invite him out for an Italian meal is like, we always meet in the city
and
head to Delfina and get ourselves some pizza. So I just didn't tell him that this particular Italian dinner was going to be a dinner of science where I was going to hook him up to a bunch of electrodes. The theme for the show was superpowers. We were doing superpowers that you can create with technology now. And I want to do mind control. So I found this company, Backyard Brains, who does what they call neuroscience for the 99%. They're experiments you can do with neuroscience on yourself. So they have these electrodes where my brain sends a signal to my arm to bend, but my arm is connected to electrodes that are connected to Tori's arm. So it contracts his muscles. So when I move my arm, he moves his arm.
Right.
So we sit down to a lovely dinner with lots of wine and spaghetti sauce.
It was hilarious.
The stuff goes flying. He never gets a bite in his mouth.
He gets really uncomfortable. You can tell he really doesn't enjoy that experience at all. I love that you went right to mind control. Not hydroplaning. No, let's do mind control.
I mean, really, because I picked a skill that I'd like to have.
Right. If you're going to go big, go home. Was there ever anything on any of the shows really that got a little bit out of hand and couldn't be aired?
I mean, we had a lot of things that didn't air or for reasons of we had a whole thing about exploding a van. And then there was a van in New York City that week on the news. So we had to cut the episode. And locally, we had a little debacle with a cannonball that kind of tore through a neighborhood. Nobody got hurt. But that was a tough episode that didn't air for a really long time because we couldn't figure out how to present that we had had a accident where a cannonball hit a ballistics trajectory that went a quarter of a mile into a neighborhood, bounced into the next neighborhood, ping pong balled through a staircase up out of a roof in the next neighborhood, and then bounced into a minivan in the next neighborhood. It was just one of those things that if you told me that story and said, will you prove this on Mythbusters? I would have been like, that's impossible. There's no way to replicate something that insane. But it was a huge learning moment and a scary moment for us. Mm-hmm. And it was something that really did shake me to the core because we do so many dangerous things and we usually have all of these experts around us. But you know, sometimes there are things that are out of your control, and I took a step back for a minute to breathe because I have a very wild job. It may all be on camera, but we're always trying to do the next big and the next exciting.
Right.
And I think sometimes you just need to realize you can't get comfortable with danger.
Right. I can't imagine what the underwriting must be like for the production of those shows.
We had the same insurers as Jackass.
Okay. That's A level.
That is A level. I think we were the safe bet.
Right.
Because we weren't trying to hurt ourselves. That was just, sometimes a side effect.
Let's go back to the book just real quick. And you said something at the top of the interview I've still been processing, and that was you kind of wrote the book for a previous version of yourself in a way. What do you see or what do you feel right now when it comes to women in STEM or a surge of interest among women and girls to get involved? Are you seeing a progress, I hope, like a hockey stick?
Well, I mean, I feel like it's definitely a time where people are noticing and trying. And I feel like when I talk to tech companies, they're all really trying to do outreach and everybody's trying to inspire girls because we all realize that diversity helps with the solution to any problem. I mean, socioeconomic, racial, gender, any kind of diversity, any background difference, we're all going to come in and think of a problem differently. Grant, Tori and I worked really well together in Mythbusters because we solved every problem where one of us was logical, one of us was practical, and one of us was technical. And when all came in with different solutions, we figured out what worked best.
Right.
So trying to get women into places where they're very male-centric, I think, is extremely important. And I definitely feel like I've seen a shift.
Good.
It's still my battle cry to try to keep girls more interested in STEM, which has brought me to my current project, which is not in the book, but I just recently started working for a toy company.
Really?
It's called Smart Girls, and it's a startup, and we are creating the first coding robot for girls. It's a really awesome, it's a self-balancing scooter like a Segway that a Barbie-sized doll rides.
Uh-huh.
And you can code her pathways and do a whole bunch of tasks with it. So it's basically learning coding through play.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I just joined the startup as a chief creative officer so that I can just throw all of my ideas about how to play and make science fun.
I'm assuming it's San Francisco startup.
It is not, but
Valley.
It's about to be. Yeah, we're all, we're all coming to the Silicon Valley because it's a New Yorker and a guy from Los Gatos, and it's a startup. So
cool.
We're actually in an investment round, so that's what we're doing now.
That's fantastic. As soon as you get stood up, please come back and talk to us about it, or send somebody else in to talk about it. I'd love to be able to follow up, because we had a young lady on, I'm going to say 6 months ago, and she's 9 years old at the time. She's now 10. And she created a board game called Coder Bunnies, and it's for girls to play to learn how to code. So this is just a next level for that, which is really great to hear.
I have an 8-year-old daughter, and I was looking for toys for her because she really loves coding and she loves Minecraft. And there was all these like robots or military looking stuff, but there wasn't anything very girly. And I'm just like, where is this toy? And when I saw this startup, I was like, oh, this is the only one out there. Cold called them. See, this is something that my journey in the book has brought me to learn to do, which is if you're interested in something, create that opportunity. So I just found them and asked one of the founders out for coffee just so I could pick their brain. And by that night, I had joined forces with them.
That's outstanding.
And I just feel like that's what you got to do. It's like, okay, I'm interested in special effects. I'm going to go find Jamie Heineman. I'm going to show him my portfolio. I'm going to get into the field. Like, I really think that you have to just create your own destiny.
And that's what the book's about. I mean, your journey's been fascinating. Carrie Byron, author of Crash Test Girl, an unlikely experiment in using the scientific method to answer life's toughest questions as you walk away from an explosion on the back of the cover.
I still got bomb range privileges. Just saying.
Hey.
Friends for life.
Right on. Carrie, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you. That was fun.
That is Carrie Byron, a Science for the Masses TV host and author of the new book, Crash Test Girl, Using Scientific Method to Answer Life's Toughest Questions. For a link to her new book and her other bona fides, please check out the show notes for this week at kgoradio.com. All of our podcasts are on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, basically wherever you pull down your podcasts. Just keyword search, Techonomics. Coming up after the break, we break down the culture of venture capital with a disruptor, a longtime VC himself, and now a professor. The call is coming from inside the house.
And I found out that their method of growth was totally different from the venture capital method. And I was totally surprised because I'd just been conditioned to thinking that the venture capital method is the only method. You get an idea, get financing, and start your idea and launch. And most of these people had never raised venture capital.
All right, startups and wannabe entrepreneurs, that's next. I'm Jason Middleton, and this is Techonomics.